This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neal Conan. 40 years after Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech, divisions within today's black community might come as a shock to the civil rights leader. For a new PBS documentary, Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates Jr. traveled the country talking to African Americans. In the housing projects of Chicago, he found some grandchildren of the Great Migration still living in the kind of crushing poverty King worked to end. In wealthy suburbs of Atlanta, he spoke with blacks who are living a life of affluence and separation. Just how far have African Americans come since integration, and what do those who have succeeded owe to those left behind? Gates takes stock of these questions for the PBS series and its companion book, America Behind the Color Line, Dialogues with African Americans. The series begins airing tonight on public television stations around the country. Later in this hour, we'll take a look at how inherited wealth perpetuates racial inequality. But now Professor Gates joins us to talk about his dialogue with black America. If you're African American, have you experienced divisions within the black community? And do those who've made it owe anything to those who haven't? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Professor Henry Louis Gates Jr., chair of Harvard's African and African American Studies Department, joins us now from our bureau in New York. Thanks so much for being on the show today, Professor Gates.
Thanks, Lynn, for having me on the program again.
Now, in the beginning of your book, you say that blacks talk more candidly when they're alone with each other than in interracial settings. First of all, I wanted to ask you about that a little bit. Tell me a little bit how the conversation is different in an all-black setting.
Well, W.E.B. Du Bois, of course, the greatest black intellectual of all time, coined the metaphor of the veil as the barrier between black culture and white culture. We always had to be on our best behavior around white people. If our worst behavior, our spontaneous behavior, our unedited behavior could be used against us, so that certain forms of spontaneous humor, for example, you could never say in front of a white person. You'd have to go to a barbershop or a beauty parlor. And what I wanted to do was to recreate that sense of cultural intimacy that one feels, that one feels in one's parlor or in the barbershop or in the beauty parlor. I wanted to lift the veil, but I wanted America to be able to overhear that intimate cultural conversation, and I'd like to think, or at least I hope, that that's what I've achieved in the film series.
So you do feel that you did accomplish to set out what you set out to do, that you were able to penetrate what may be a facade, I guess, that blacks may put on at times.
Well, a necessary protective barrier. It's like protective coloration, as it were, a kind of armor. Because we were so vulnerable. I think we're much less vulnerable now in public. You know, after 1968, I mean, think about someone like Richard Pryor. Richard Pryor's historically significant because he was the first black comedian, at least in my opinion, whose white act, as it were, was the same as his black act. There used to be, say, Red Fox would perform one way before a black audience and another way in front of a white audience. Richard Pryor famously introducing the N-word into public discourse broke down that barrier. So, and then look at the hip-hop kids who use the N-word, their variation on it all the time. So there's less of a cultural distance now than there was before, but there's still a cultural difference, of course. And I think that when you see the series, you'll get a feeling for this spontaneous intimacy, this honesty, that the freedom to be ourselves without recrimination that at least I've experienced for the last 53 years as a black person living with other black people.
Was there a question that you set out to answer, a central question that you set out to answer?
Absolutely. Du Bois asked and answered famously at the beginning of the 20th century, what would the problem of the 20th century be? And he said it would be the problem of the color line. I wanted to know, what would the problem of the 21st century be? Now, Du Bois was the lordly, grand intellectual, so he sat down at his desk and answered his own question. Rather, I wanted to travel around the country and ask African Americans, the rich and famous and powerful, on the one hand, people like Colin Powell and Vernon Jordan, Franklin Raines, the first black CEO of a Fortune 500 company, Chris Tucker, Bernie Mac, Alicia Keys, Quincy Jones, Maya Angelou. But on the other hand, the anonymous, sometimes the infamous, the single heads of households in the Robert Taylor homes, excuse me, in the south side of Chicago. Drug dealers, ex-drug dealers. I went to Cook County Jail and interviewed prisoners. The full range, representative sample of class types within the African-American community.
Although I have to say that it seemed to be largely very successful and often very affluent blacks or very poor, very unsuccessful, and as you say, in many cases, destitute in our societies. There wasn't a lot of middle ground there.
Well, in Ebony Towers there, and in Ebony Towers is the film about the new black middle class. There are middle management people there, middle class people. And even in The Streets of Heaven, which is on the south side of Chicago, there are working class and middle class people. So all in all, if you graph it like we did, we have a pretty representative sample of the class types within the African-American community.
And in the series, you focus on four groups. You divide it into four groups. The urban elite of the Northeast, I think you called the Ebony Towers, mm-hmm. middle-class blacks returning to the South, African-Americans in Hollywood, and of course, blacks in urban Chicago. How did you come up with those four themes, those general themes? How did you decide to group it that way?
Well, in the 35 years since the brutal assassination of Martin Luther King, the black middle class has almost quadrupled, which is wonderful, and that's largely due to affirmative action. But at the same time, the percentage of black children living at or beneath the poverty line is somewhere between 35% and 40%. That's what it was the day Dr. King died. What that means is that two distinct classes have arisen in the black community since 1968. So I tried to figure out a way to allow the people in those different classes to speak. And that's how we came up with the four-part division. And the most remarkable sociological phenomenon probably since Dr. King died is the fact that middle-class blacks in the North are moving back to the South. If anyone had said this when I was growing up in the 50s, we would have thought that they were crazy. You know, you could look in the whole history of African-American literature, and there are thousands of songs and rhymes and references to follow the drinking gourd. The drinking gourd is the North Star, or is the Big Dipper involving the North Star. Follow the North Star, you know, go north and find your freedom. But there's not one that says, black man, black woman, go to Mississippi, or as my daddy says, Mississippi, Miss Obama, all them missies, go south to find your freedom. But that's what happened in the 1990s. And so I wanted to record that. And then Halle Berry and Denzel had just received Academy Awards and the uh-huh. image machine of Hollywood. I wanted to see, where are we playing? How is race playing itself out in Hollywood? So if you add it all up, that makes the four parts of the series.
One couple that you interviewed in the suburbs of Atlanta lived in this very wealthy community, an all-black community, very wealthy. You seem to be very uncomfortable with that and seem to really question whether this is where the civil rights movement should have taken blacks. I just wonder, I'd like to hear a little bit more about how you felt about that and what your thinking is about that.
Oh, no, I wasn't comfortable with it personally. I was, as in the clip that you played, I was being devil's advocate. I was trying to be a good journalist.
Right, but at the end, you're sitting by the Martin Luther King Center, I think, there in Atlanta, and you question whether, gee, what would Martin Luther King have thought of all this?
Well, that was honest. I wonder what Martin Luther King would have thought. I have to confess, I mean, full disclosure, that a year ago, I looked actively for a brownstone in Harlem myself. So I would be a hypocrite to say that I didn't understand the impulse to want to be surrounded by other middle-class people who are black or live in a predominantly black environment. It's something that appeals to me enormously. I don't only want to live in a black environment, but every summer I go to Oak Bluffs and Martha's Vineyard, and I'm surrounded by black middle-class people, and it's the happiest month of my life. But for the film, this is certainly a question. It's certainly an irony, an ironic legacy of Dr. King's dream. Dr. King, when he died, he was trying to get people to move from all-black neighborhoods because we had been confined to all-black neighborhoods. And I think that my feelings are best expressed in the film by Dr. Maya Angelou, who looks at me and says, look, there is a difference between enforced segregation, legal segregation on the one hand, and willing association on the other. And as far as she's concerned, Martin Luther King died so that we could have willing association. And I think that's a fair assessment.
We're talking with Professor Henry Louis Gates, Jr. about his new book, America Behind the Color Line. If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 1-800-989-8255. I'd like to take a call from Tyrone in Norfolk, Virginia. Hi, Tyrone.
Hello, good afternoon.
Go ahead.
Yes, I think the question was posed earlier, whether or not African-Americans who have succeeded owe anything to those who have not yet succeeded. To that answer, I'll leave that for another caller to debate. But I do feel that African Americans and others who have succeeded, they have a responsibility to the others who have not yet succeeded to do the best they can, to achieve as most they can, because and by doing so, they open the gate wider for those who will come behind them. Mm-hmm. That for an African American male who is 6'8", who doesn't play basketball, that was somewhat seen to be a rarity. But for the same African-American person to excel in academics, that would seem also a rarity. I'd like to get to the day where for us to excel in all aspects of our culture and education would not seem to be in the rarity, but the expected thing.
Oh, absolutely. I agree. Colin Powell's quite eloquent, excuse me, in the series about the historical responsibility that the successful members of the black middle class have. The great responsibility that the successful members of the black community have toward all those left behind. I grew up in West Virginia. I know all kind of successful white people, and they didn't sit around talking about their poor brothers stuck up in the Appalachian Mountains. I mean, they're just functioning as individuals. And so I put this to General Powell, and he said, no, we have to fulfill Du Bois's dream of the talented 10th. We are the vanguard of our people. We have to reach back, serve as role models, put our money where our mouth is, encourage the government, and now this is me speaking, not Colin Powell, encourage the government to create a federal jobs program, encourage the government to create that Marshall Plan for the cities that the National Urban League calls for every year. But more than that, we have also to address the behavioral causes of poverty. The causes of poverty are both structural and attitudinal or individual. There are historic legacies of slavery and a century of de jure racism, and we all know about those. But in addition, so many of our people have internalized our own oppression. At one point, the average age of a grandmother in the Robert Taylor Homes where I filmed was in the mid-30s. Well, no white racist makes you get pregnant when you're 16. No white racist makes you do drugs or sell drugs and end up in the Cook County jail and then ultimately the federal prison. No white racist makes you equate getting straight A's or speaking standard English or remaining in school and excelling with being white, which was the result of a poll that appeared a few years ago, I believe, in the Washington Post. Inner city black kids were asked to list things white, and they said getting straight A's in school, speaking standard English, visiting the Smithsonian. This is a nightmare. If anyone had said this kind of thing when I was growing up in the 50s, your mother would have smacked you upside your head, and then they would have checked you into an insane asylum. Too many of our people think it's easier to be a basketball player than to be a brain surgeon. In 1990, there were about 20
Professor Gates,
times.
I'm going to ask you to hold that thought for a moment. We're going to take a short break, and we'll continue our discussion when we return. We're talking with Professor Henry Louis Gates, Jr. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking with Henry Louis Gates, Jr. about his new book and PBS series, America Behind the Color Lines, dialogues with African Americans. Half a century after the Civil Rights Movement, the black community faces economic and class divisions. If you're part of that community, is there a responsibility to bridge these divides, and how can it be done? You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Professor Gates, I wanted to ask you, we were talking before the break about this idea of responsibility, those who have succeeded, have made it to the middle class, what their responsibility is to those left behind. And you were mentioning that Colin Powell had spoken very eloquently on this. But I wondered what else you found in the communities, let's say in that Atlanta community of wealthy or middle class, upper middle class American blacks. To what degree did you find a sense of responsibility and a willingness to sort of take on that responsibility to help those left behind?
Well, I think that there is a tremendous urge to reach out and help among the black middle class, but there's also a tremendous amount of confusion about how to reach out. I did a piece for Sports Illustrated a few years ago. It was 1991, and I looked at the 1990 census, and we counted the number of black lawyers, black doctors, black dentists, and black professional athletes. And the figures are approximate. There were about 20,000 black lawyers, about 14,000 black doctors, 5,600 black dentists. And do you know how many black professional athletes there were? 1,200 black professional athletes in 1990. Mm-hmm. Now, the average black person, the average white person, thinks that the figures would all be reversed. In fact, most people think there's probably 100,000 black professional athletes if you watch basketball and you watch football. But it's not. It's easier to be a black brain surgeon, statistically, than it is to make it into the NBA. But our people, too many of us, have lost our way. The black middle class is perpetuating itself, and far too often the black underclass is perpetuating itself.
Can I ask you about one particular part of the program and of the book that I found particularly interesting in terms of that division was a conversation you had with a gentleman in Chicago who explained how class divisions began with the Great Migration, with the fact that there were two waves of the Great Migration from south to north.
That's right.
And I found that particularly interesting. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
Sure. It was Dr. Timuel Black. The first place, class divisions really began in slavery, as I think you know, with the division between house servants and field servants, and often the house servants were the mulatto offspring of the master or of the overseer. And so color also stood in for class. And by the way, as a sidebar, we see that in the Black Hollywood film, where I interview several brown-skinned, as we say, actresses who complain about the fact that you have to look like Lena Horne or Halle Berry in order to get an A-list part. But what Dr. Black talks about is the first wave of migrants were essentially the old colored middle class had moved from the country to the city. The second wave, he said, were what we called, unfortunately, as he puts it, the country Negroes. And so there were two waves, but they were different classes within the black community that hit the northern cities. And the gap between the black middle class and the black underclass was just as great as the gap between the white community and the black community. In fact, the black middle class was often guilty of putting down the black underclass or distancing themselves for their own greater potential advantage. E. Franklin Frazier, the great sociologist, wrote a book in 1957 called The Black Bourgeoisie. And if you read it, you would not want to be a member of the black middle class because they were so color struck, they were so biased, they were embarrassed about black culture, and they certainly were embarrassed about being around with these dark-complected, uneducated, southern, rural black people, et cetera, et cetera. That's changed. No black middle class home I've ever been in did not have books about the black experience, a Romare Bearden print on the wall, Jacob Lawrence print on the wall, a shelf full of African-American music. People go to Africa. They have pictures of Africa all around their homes. But we don't know how to reach out and bridge the class divide. Right. And that's why I think that we need a national movement that would stress education, first of all, school reform and education as the new face of the civil rights movement, along with economic empowerment. Yeah. Schools, you know, when I was growing up in the 50s, I was born in 1950, the blackest thing you could be was a black lawyer or a black doctor. Thurgood Marshall, Mary McLeod Bethune, Martin Luther King, these were our heroes, not basketball players and football players. I mean, don't get me wrong. I just flew back from the Super Bowl to do the program. I love sports, too. But our value system has become skewed. We need after-school programs. We need, my Jewish friends laugh when I say what I'm about to say, but we need the African-American version of Hebrew schools. Our churches, our mosques have to be sites for after-school programs where we teach computer skills and African-American history, and we have to change the image of education within the black community. Nerds need to be our heroes, again, like they were in the 1950s. But they're not. We have adopted these images that could have been invented and propagated by racists. Look, if George Wallace and Orville Faubus had sat down in 1960 and said, how can we control these black people after they get these civil rights laws passed? One of them could have said, having drunk too much bourbon, well, we convince them that education's white. We'll convince them to have babies when they're teenagers. We'll convince them to do drugs and sell them and that they'll never get caught. And they would have laughed and said, oh, I wish we could have pulled that off. But nobody would ever believe that. That's what's happened to a large segment of our community. So we have to address the structural, institutional causes of racism on the one hand, but we have to change the attitudes of our own people on the other hand. Our own people have been so beaten down by the system that they have given up. And that's where the black middle class comes in.
We're talking with Professor Henry Louis Gates, Jr. If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 1-800-989-8255. And we'd like to take a call now from David in California. Hi, David.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I was just listening in, and I was known when I was growing up as an Oreo cookie. I don't know if you've ever heard that term before.
Oh, yeah. I keep a whole crate of Oreos around. I've been called that so much. Go ahead.
When I was going to school, you know, I was more interested in going to school rather than being at school. For the other kids that were in school, they were what we called the basement rats. They would hang down in the basement, take basic reading, basic math, and were more interested in, you know, where they were getting the money. I only could guess. They were Italian suits and who had the bigger boombox. They weren't concerned with any kind of progression that was available. So I'm always tired of hearing somebody saying these opportunities weren't there, when it just wasn't something they wanted to pursue. It was there for me, just like it was there for them, and I was at more of a disadvantage than what most of the kids that were there were at.
How do you account for the difference? How do you account for the difference in attitude that, between yourself and these other kids?
Because I basically didn't like the fact that without being able to progress, I took the initiative on my own to say I was never going to do anything by just hanging around in the basement. Mm-hmm. They never, I guess, never wanted to see that there were any other possibilities. And I would have to thank good teachers for that. There were a few of them in the school that took an interest in students. And if you showed any sort of interest of applying yourself, they would show an interest in you. But if you didn't, if you just were there to be there, that's what they would allow you to do.
Okay, thanks for your call, David.
You're welcome.
Professor Gates, I just have to ask you, I hear a little bit in David's comment maybe an anger or a sort of a rejection of some of these people who rejected him when he was younger for being too studious and being a nerd, as you said earlier. He's maybe a little, he's not maybe perhaps inclined to feel that he needs to help people like that now.
Well, that sort of pain is certainly understandable, particularly when you're an adolescent. But I think as adults, we have to realize Well, the role of context is a way to put it. Look, you can't live in an inner city of despair and anger and nihilism and alienation without it having an effect, without it being the major shaping force in your life. And that's why we need both federal and private programs to help reverse this tide of negativism, to remind our people of our origins, of the origins of education, the role of education historically for black people, how it was firing a bullet straight into the heart of white institutional racism. And we have forgotten that. So, yeah, there are, as I show in the film, there are tremendous class divides, and they play themselves out at the level of education. But if look at the breakdown of the family structure. 69% of all homes in black homes in Chicago are headed by single mothers. Well, it's very difficult for in that economic environment for and 45%, only 45% of the black community in Chicago in any given week is gainfully employed. Okay, just consider those two statistics. It's very difficult to imagine that being a site for the nurturing of the love of learning, just by definition. So that's why we have to intervene in that structure, both federally and privately, to reverse this situation, to change the context. That's why we also need a federal jobs program. I interviewed a young man named Lindell who was selling drugs, $6,000 a day he was clearing, $6,000 a day. He stopped. He was just finished his first semester of college. And when I interviewed him, I said, Lindell, what do you do? He said, I work at Popeyes. I said, do you mind telling me how much do you make? He said, $600 a month. I said, Lindell, do you ever think about that? $6,000 a day? He said, are you crazy? I think about it every minute of the day. It is the lure that wants to suck me back there. But I want to defer gratification. I want to make it in the system. I don't want to go to jail. We need to give our people hope in the system again, that if they stay in school, if they study, they will get an education that will suit them for a meaningful job in a 21st century, highly technological, global economy. And that's not what enough of our people have facing them today. All that face them today is McDonald's and Popeyes.
Well, but, you know, one other theme in this book and in this documentary is the theme of entrepreneurship. For instance, you interview Russell Simmons, and he's someone who began his he found his entrepreneurial skills as a drug dealer, and then later on became a very successful entrepreneur in the music industry. And you talk about that this is sort of a moment in the black community for entrepreneurship.
Yeah, I was quite surprised by two things particularly in the film concerning entrepreneurship. The first was Russell Simmons. Russell Simmons has redefined the role of the entrepreneur as the renegade figure. We used to call it the bad nigger figure in African-American folklore. Rather than that being the drug dealer or the person that goes astray, Russell Simmons' claim is that hip-hop has made the entrepreneur the maroon, you know, the renegade, the true revolutionary on the street. And this is relevant because the school systems have failed so many of our children, teenagers, young people, that he thinks that they can recuperate their lives by pursuing entrepreneurial activities that are legal. He said, we've always had entrepreneurs. When I was growing up, it was numbers runners, illegal numbers runners, and then it became drug dealers. And Russell admits that he was a drug dealer. But now he's channeled those skills along legal channels. The other program is the one run in Bedford-Stuyvesant, by Dr. Lenora Fulani, which in 12 weeks takes inner-city kids who have been failed by the school system and gets them apprenticeships on Wall Street. She says, by training them how to be white. This is what she tells the kids on the first day of class. And she said that all of her friends, or all her liberal friends, say, oh, this is terrible. You're destroying African-American culture. And she turned to me and she said, honey, after 12 weeks, these kids will still be black. And I said, well, what do you mean by being white? She said, I teach them how to look white people in the eye. I teach them how to shake their hands. I teach them how to buy a suit, how to tie a tie. How to walk the walk and talk the talk of Wall Street. It's a performance, and we learn the performance in middle-class environments, in homes, in school. You know, I went to Yale. Yale is a leadership performance training school. She teaches them in this brilliant program, and I feature this in the film series.
Henry Louis Gates is our guest today on Talk of the Nation, and you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're going to take a call now from Mike in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I wanted to ask Professor Gates, when he did his interviews, did, in fact, he, I know church came in and did it take center stage, mainly because, well, I'm a black professional, so is my wife. We live in a community that's probably, I guess you'd call it upscale. We find, or at least we found, that not only do you have to have education, which I'm an engineer, you have to have the ability, but you also have the ability, you need the ability to exist, I guess, and prosper along with the associates, which are usually white. So you have to develop some way to coexist and deal with people that you got to work with. Mm-hmm. This means that our community, we found most of the churches are white. It's a dilemma. It's a paradox for us. We certainly would, we grew up in black churches. All of us did. But just like anyone else, we find it harder to attend churches in communities we don't live in. Mm-hmm. It's just it's a terrible. And there are no models for addressing this type of thing. You know, we don't see any easily accessible models for this. I mean, you almost have to feel your way through. Nobody teaches a class on how black professionals interact with other African Americans that are not professionals, so to speak, or that are middle and lower middle class. It's not an easy prescription. And I wanted to know, had that question come up? If so, did you have an answer for that? I'd certainly like to hear it.
Okay, thanks for your call.
Well, many of the black people who were moving from the North back to the South said in the interviews that they began this, this quest for black culture, the return to black culture, from the suburbs on Sundays by going to church. That they would live in these all-white neighborhoods, and there was something fundamentally missing about their lives. And so they would go all the way back to the inner city to go to the church that they had fled from, or their mother and father had fled from when they escaped from the inner city. And that this led, this sort of grew, the cumulative power of this grew into them wanting to live in all-black, upper-middle-class neighborhoods. But at the same time, I interviewed black families who said that their children's worst nightmare or worst enemy in one way was the stigma that came from other black kids who weren't in the middle class, so that they were laughed at, they were scorned. A person earlier used the Oreo cookie metaphor. And that's why we need these after-school programs.
All right. We're going to continue this discussion after a short break. We're taking stock of black accomplishment 40 years after the March on Washington and looking at where the community goes from here with Henry Louis Gates, Jr. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're talking about America Behind the Color Line with noted intellectual Henry Louis Gates, Jr., who joins us from our New York bureau. And let's take a call now from Rose, who is in Santa Rosa, California. Hi, Rose.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Go ahead.
Hi. Professor Gates, it's such a pleasure to hear you and to have this chance to talk to you.
Thank you, Rose.
Well, you're welcome. I know that the issues are pretty complex here, so I'm going to try to be brief, and forgive me if I reduce things down a little bit. It seems like in the conversation there's a division between folks who are coming up from bottom and folks who are very, very successful. That's mm-hmm. been a theme in the conversation. And what's not as clear, but I think we're getting there with the discussion on entrepreneurship, is the idea of aspiring to the middle or aspiring mm-hmm. to the concept of living well enough. Mm-hmm. And that's a harder thing not only for black folks but for white folks to do as well. I guess the idea that I have is, when I was working as a legal assistant, I finished my PhD a couple of years ago, but beforehand I had been working as a legal assistant and I worked in government, and there were people without degrees who were white who were succeeding quite well. There were people 17 years old on the floor of the Chicago Trade who were millionaires and didn't give an education a second thought. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering about how to teach young African Americans to dream in diverse ways rather than a kind of dichotomous message that I got when I was growing up.
I think you're absolutely right. When we have lost the embrace of deferred gratification, the merits of deferred gratification, going for the long haul. My father, who's 90 years old, bless him, worked 37 years, two jobs for 37 years as a factory worker and a janitor to put me and my brother through college. My brother's an oral surgeon, and there's little old me bringing up the rear. You know, it didn't occur to them that there was anything wrong with it. They would live out certain dreams and fantasies through their kids. And, you know, I happen to believe that. My brother believes that. Our generation believes that. Deferred gratification has bit the dust for too many of our people. And by our people, I mean Americans in general, but also African Americans as well. Franklin Raines, the CEO of Fannie Mae, says in the film, "Our goal has to be to produce the same percentage of rich black people as rich white people, poor black people as poor white people, black people in the middle class and the working class as white people in the middle and the working class." And that's not what the bell curve of class looks like for the African-American community today. We have these two nodes, a huge poverty node and then a smaller but ever-growing node of the middle class. And we have to spread that out. And so you're absolutely correct. The reason I keep talking about after-school programs and a federal jobs program is that our schools are such disasters. I can't figure out why the Secretary of Education or the Bush administration or whomever it should be can't look at the kind of programs that we looked at in the film. Daniel Rose's chess teaching program curriculum at the Mott Hall School in New York. Lenora Filani's entrepreneurial school. Anthony Appiah and I have started the Martin Luther King after-school program in Boston. It's just spread to Baltimore. It's going to Cleveland, teaching computer skills and African-American history. There must be a dozen things that have been demonstrated to work. Why these can't be scaled up and institutionalized in the schools? But we can't wait till that happens. We need, as a community, the African-American community, the African-American middle class, the leadership class, has to take the initiative, start these programs, and they will instill, in part, deferred gratification. They will instill the knowledge of roles, occupations, such as the one that you described, which our kids don't even know about. That's why Lenora Filani's program is so good. It's teaching kids to dream, to aspire toward goals that they didn't even know existed before, and they're not getting it in their schools. The schools are a nightmare. The public schools are a nightmare, and they need massive overhaul.
All right. Henry Louis Gates, Jr., thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Professor Gates is chair of the African and African American Studies Department at Harvard University. He joined us from our bureau in New York City. His series, America Behind the Color Lines, Dialogues with African Americans, premieres tomorrow on public television stations around the country. The companion book is already available.